added Cloud Dancer softly. And the Arrowhead is growing old. It's said that he's afraid of the white women these days, and terrified of dying, so terrified that he falls to his knees by night and howls like a beaten dog, and they say his cooks have to make him calf's blood pudding every morning, because that's supposed to keep a man young, and he keeps a hanged man's finger bone under his pillow to protect him from the white women. He's married 4 times in the last 7 years. His wives get younger and younger, but still, none of them has given him what he wants most dearly.
So the Arrowhead has no son yet?
Cloud Dancer shook his head. No. But all the same, his grandson will rule us someday because the old fox married one of his daughters off to Cosimo the Fair. Violante, known to everyone, Lance. Her ugliness. And she had a son by Cosimo before he went away to die. They say her father made her acceptable to the Laughing Prince by giving her a valuable manuscript to take for her dowry, and the best illuminator at his court into the bargain.
Oh, yes, yes.
The Laughing Prince was once as keen on written papers as on good food, but now his precious books are mouldering away. Nothing interests him any more, least of all his subjects. There are rumours that it's all gone exactly as the Arrowhead planned, and that he himself made sure his son-in-law would never return from Capricorn's fortress, so that his grandson could succeed to the throne.
Yeah, the rumours are probably true. Dustfinger looked at the crowd in the stuffy room. Strolling peddlers, physicians, journeymen, craftsmen, players with darned sleeves, one man and an unhappy-looking brownie sitting on the floor beside him. Many looked as if they didn't know how they were going to pay for the wine they were drinking. There were few happy faces to be seen here, few faces free of care, sickness, and resentment. Well, what had he expected? Had he hoped that misfortune would have stolen away while he was gone? No. He had wanted to come back. That was all he'd hoped for in 10 long years. Not back to paradise. He just wanted to come home. Doesn't a fish want to be back in the water, even if there's a perch lying in wait for it? A drunk staggered against the table and almost spilled the wine. Dustfinger reached for the jug.
What about Capricorn's men? Firefox and the rest? Are they all dead?
In your dreams. Cloud Dancer laughed bitterly. All the fire raisers who escaped Cosimo's attack were welcomed to the Castle of Night with open arms. The Arrowhead made Firefox his herald, and these days the Piper, Capricorn's old minstrel, sings his dark songs in the Castle of Silver Towers. He wears silk and velvet and his pockets are full of gold.
The Piper's still around?
Dustfinger passed his hand over his face. Heavens, have you no good news to tell me? Something to make me glad to be home again.
Ha! 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 Cloud Dancer laughed so loudly that Sootbird turned and glanced at him. The best news is that you're back! He said. We've missed you, Master of the Fire!
They say that the fairies sigh as they dance by night since you left us so faithlessly, and the Black Prince tells his bear stories about you before falling asleep.
So the prince is still around, too. Good.
Relieved, Dustfinger took a sip of the wine, although it really did taste vile. He hadn't dared to ask about the prince, for fear he might hear something like Cosimo's sad story.
Oh, he's doing fine!
Cloud Dancer raised his voice as 2 peddlers at the next table began to quarrel.
Still the same. Black his pitch, quick with his tongue, and even quicker with his knife. Never seen without his bear.
Dustfinger smiled. Yes, this was good news indeed. The Black Prince. Bear tamer. Knife thrower. Probably still fretting angrily at the way of the world. Dustfinger had known him since they were both homeless, orphaned children. At the age of 11, they'd stood side by side in the pillory over on the far side of the forest where they were born, and they'd still smelled of rotten vegetables 2 days later. They had both been born in Argenta, the Silverland, the realm of the Adderhead. Cloud Dancer looked at his face.
Well, he asked, when are you finally going to ask the question you've been wanting to since I clapped you on the shoulder? Go on!
before I'm too drunk to answer you.
Dustfinger had to smile. He couldn't help it. Cloud Dancer had always known how to see into other people's hearts, though you might not have thought so from his face.
Betty will. Which will I,
How is she?
At last!
Cloud Dancer smiled with such self-satisfaction that two gaps in his teeth showed.
Well, first, she's still very beautiful. Lives in a house now. Doesn't sing and dance anymore. Doesn't wear brightly colored skirts. Pins up her hair like a farmer's wife. She tends a plot of land up on the hill behind the castle, growing herbs for the physicians. Even nettle buys from her. She lives on that, sometimes well, sometimes not so well, bringing up her children.
Dustfinger tried to look indifferent, but Cloud Dancer's smile told him that he wasn't succeeding.
What about that spice merchant who was always after her?
What about him? He'd have years ago, he's probably living in some big house by the sea, growing richer with every sack of pepper his ships bring in.
Then she didn't marry him?
No. She was another man.
Another man?
Once again, Dustfinger tried to sound indifferent, and once again he failed. Cloud Dancer enjoyed keeping him in suspense for a while, and then went on.
Yes, another man. He soon died, poor fellow. But she has a child by him. A boy.
Dustfinger said nothing, listening to his own thudding heart. His stupid heart.
What about the girls?
Oh, the girls! Yes, them. I wonder who their father can have been.
Cloud Dancer was smiling again, like a little boy who has pulled off a mischievous trick.
Brianna's as lovely as her mother already, although she's inherited your red hair.
And Rosanna, the younger?
Her hair was dark, like her mother's. The smile on Cloud Dancer's face disappeared as if Dustfinger had wiped it away.
Charles been dead for a long time, he said softly. There was a fever 2 winters after you went away. Many died of it. Even Nettle couldn't help them.
Dustfinger drew bright, damp lines on the table with his forefinger, which was sticky from the wine. Dead. Much might be lost in the space of 10 years. For a moment he tried desperately to remember her face. Such a little face. But it blurred, as if he had spent too long over the attempt to forget it. Amid all the noise, Cloud Dancer sat with him in silence for a long time. Then, at last, he rose, ponderously. It wasn't easy to get up from the low bench with his stiff leg.
"I must be off, my friend," he said. "I still have 3 letters to deliver, 2 of them up there in Umbra.
Ought to be at the city gate before dark. The guards will have their little joke again and refuse to let me in."
Dustfinger was still drawing lines on the dark wood of the table.
2 winters after you went away. The words stung like nettles in his head. Where are the others camping at the moment?
Just outside the wall of Umbra. Our prince's beloved grandson celebrates his birthday soon. Every entertainer and minstrel is welcome at the castle on that day.
Dustfinger nodded without raising his head.
Well, I'll see. Maybe I'll go along too.
He abruptly rose from the hard bench. The girl by the hearth looked at them. His younger daughter would have been about her age now if the fever hadn't carried her off. Together with Cloud Dancer, he made his way past the crowded benches and chairs to the door. It was still fine outside, a sunny autumn day, clad in bright foliage like a strolling player.
"Come to Umbra with me!"
Cloud Dancer laid a hand on his shoulder.
"My horse will carry too. We can always find a place to sleep there."
But Dustfinger shook his head.
"Later," he said, looking down the muddy road. "It's time I paid a visit."
Chapter 7. Meggie's Decision. Mo came home just as they were all sitting down to breakfast, and Risa kissed him as if he'd been away for weeks. Meggie hugged him harder than usual, too, relieved that he had come back safe and sound, but she avoided looking him straight in the eye. Mo knew her too well. He would have spotted her guilty conscience at once, and Meggie's conscience was very guilty. The reason was the sheet of paper hidden among her schoolbooks up in her room, closely written in her own hand, although the words were by someone else.
Miggy had spent hours copying out what Orpheus had written. Every time she got something wrong, she had begun again from the beginning for fear that a single mistake could spoil everything. She had added just 3 words. Where the passage mentioned a boy, in the sentences left unread by Orpheus, Miggy had added, "and the girl." 3 nondescript, perfectly ordinary words, so ordinary that it was overwhelmingly likely that they occurred somewhere in the pages of Inkheart. She couldn't check, however, because the only copy of the book she would have needed to do that was now in Basta's hands. Basta. The mere sound of his name reminded Maggie of black days and black nights, black with fear. Mo had brought her a present to make peace between them, as he always did when they had a quarrel. A small notebook bound by himself, just the right size for her jacket pocket, with a marbled paper cover. Mo knew how much Maggie liked marbled patterns. She had been only 9 when he had taught her how to color them for herself. Guilt went to her heart when he put the notebook down by her plate, and for a moment she wanted to tell him everything, just as she had always done. But a glance from Farid prevented her. That glance said, "No, Miggy, he won't let you go there, ever." So she kept quiet, kissed Mo, whispered, "Thank you," and said no more, quickly bending her head, her tongue heavy with the words she hadn't spoken. Luckily, no one noticed her sad expression. The others were still anxious about Farid's news of Basta. Eleanor had gone to the police on Mo's advice, but her visit to them had done nothing to improve her mood.
"Just as I told you," she said crossly, working away at the cheese with her knife as if it were the cause of all this trouble. "Those fools don't believe a word I said. A couple of sheep in uniform would have listened better. You know I don't like dogs. Maybe I ought to get some after all. A couple of huge black brutes to tear Buster apart the moment he comes through my garden gate. A Dobsterman dog, yes, a Dobsterman dog. Or 2, isn't a Dobsterman the dog that eats people?"
"You mean a Doberman?" Mo winked across the table at Maggie. It broke her heart. There he was winking at her, his deceitful daughter, who was planning to go right away, to somewhere he probably couldn't follow her. Perhaps her mother would understand, but Mo? No, not Mo. Never. Maggie bit her lip so hard that it hurt, while Eleanor, still in a state of agitation, went on.
"And I could hire a bodyguard. You can do that, can't you? One with a pistol. No, not just a pistol. Armed to the teeth. Knives, guns, everything. And so big that Bastard's black heart would stop at the mere sight of him. How does that sound?"
Maggie saw Mo suppress a smile with difficulty. "How does it sound? Sounds as if you've been reading too many thrillers, Eleanor."
"Well, I have read a lot of thrillers," she said, injured. "They're very informative if you don't usually mix much with criminals. What's more, I can't forget seeing Buster's knife at your throat."
"Nor can I, believe me." Maggie saw his hand go to his throat as if, just for a moment, he felt the sharp blade against his skin again. "All the same, I think you're worrying unnecessarily. I had plenty of time to think it over on the drive back, and I don't believe Buster will come all the way here just to get revenge." "Revenge for what? For being saved from Capricorn's shadow? And by us?" "No. He'll have had this Orpheus read him back by now, back into the book. Basta never liked our world half as much as Capricorn did. Some things about it made him very nervous." He spread jam on top of his bread and cheese. Eleanor watched this, as usual, with horror. And Mo, as usual, ignored her disapproving glance.
"So what about those threats he shouted after the boy?"
"Well, he was angry that he'd gotten away, wasn't he? I don't have to tell you the kind of thing Basta says when he's angry. I'm only surprised he was actually clever enough to find out that Dustfinger had the book. And I'd like to know where he found this man Orpheus, too. Seems to be better than me at reading aloud."
"Nonsense."
Eleanor's voice sounded cross but relieved, too.
"The only one who may be as good at it as you are is your daughter."
Mo smiled at Maggie and put another slice of cheese on top of the jam. "Thanks, very flattering. But however that may be, our knife-happy friend Basta has gone, and I hope he's taken the wretched book with him and put an end to that story forever. There'll be no more need for Eleanor to jump when she hears something rustling in the garden at night, and Darius won't have to dream of Basta's knife, which means that the news Farid has brought is in fact very good news. I hope you've all thanked him warmly." Farid smiled shyly as Mo raised his coffee cup to him, but Meggy saw the anxiety in his black eyes. If Mo was right, then by now Basta was in the same place as Dustfinger, and they all thought Mo was right. He could see the relief in Darius and Eleanor's faces, and Risa put her arms around Mo's neck and smiled as if everything was fine again. Eleanor began asking Mo questions about the books he had so shockingly abandoned to answer Meggy's phone call, and Darius was trying to tell Risa about the new system of classification he had thought up for Eleanor's library. But Farid looked at his empty plate. Against the background of its white china, he was probably seeing Basta's knife at Dustfinger's neck. Basta. The name stuck in Meggy's throat like a pebble. She kept thinking the same thing. If Mo was right, Basta was now where she soon hoped to be herself. In the Ink World. She was going to try it that very night. She would try to use her own voice and Orpheus's words to make her way through the thicket of written letters into the Wayless Wood. Farid had pleaded with her to wait no longer. He was beside himself with anxiety for Dustfinger, and Mo's remarks had certainly done nothing to change that.
"Please, Meggy," he had begged her again and again, "please read it."
Meggy looked across the table at Mo. He was whispering something to Risa, and she laughed. You heard her voice only when she laughed. Mo put his arm around her and his eyes sought Meggy. When her bed was empty tomorrow morning, he wouldn't look as carefree as he did now. Would he be angry, or merely sad?
Risa laughed when, for her and Eleanor's benefit, he mimicked the horror of the collector whose books he had abandoned so disgracefully when Meggy had phoned. And Meggy had to laugh, too, when he imitated the poor man's voice. The collector had obviously been very fat and breathless. Eleanor was the only one who didn't laugh.
"I don't think that's funny, Mortimer," she said sharply. "Personally, I probably have shot you if you'd simply gone off leaving my poor books behind, all sick and dirty."
"Yes, I expect you would."
Mo gave Meggy a conspiratorial look, as he always did when Eleanor lectured him or his daughter on the way to treat books or the rules of her library.
"Oh, Mo, if only you knew," thought Meggy. "If only you knew."
She felt as if he would read her secret in her face any minute now. Abruptly, she pushed back her chair, muttered, "I'm not hungry," and she went off to Eleanor's library. Where else? Whenever she wanted to escape her own thoughts, she went to books for help. She was sure to find something to keep her mind occupied until evening finally came and they all went to bed, suspecting nothing. Looking at Eleanor's library, you couldn't tell that scarcely more than a year ago it had contained nothing but a red rooster hanging dead in front of empty shelves, while Eleanor's finest books burned on the lawn outside. The jar that Eleanor had filled with some of their pale ashes still stood beside her bed. Meggy ran her forefinger over the backs of the books. They were arranged side by side on the shelves again now, like piano keys. Some shelves were still empty, but Eleanor and Darius were always out and about visiting second-hand bookshops and auctions to replace those lost treasures with new and equally wonderful books.
Orpheus, where was the story of Orpheus?
Meggy was on her way over to the shelf where the Greeks and Romans whispered their ancient stories when the library door opened behind her, and Mo came in.
"Risa says you have a sheet of paper that Farid brought with him into your room. Can I see it?" He was trying to sound as casual as if he were just asking about the weather, but he'd never been any good at pretending. Mo couldn't pretend any more than he could tell lies. "Why?"
Meggy leaned against Eleanor's books as if they would strengthen her backbone.
"Why? Because I'm curious, remember? And what's more," he added, looking at the backs of the books, as if he could find the right words there, "and what's more, I think it would be better to burn that sheet of paper."
"Burn it?" Meggy looked at him incredulously. "But why?"
"I know it sounds as if I'm seeing ghosts," he said, taking a book off the shelf, opening it, and leafing absentmindedly through it.
"But that piece of paper, Meggy?
I feel it's like an open door, a door that we'd be well advised to close once and for all, before Farid tries disappearing into that damn story, too."
"What if he does?"
Meggy couldn't help the cool note that crept into her voice, as if she were talking to a stranger.
"Why can't you understand? He only wants to find Dustfinger.
to warn him about Basta.
Mo closed the book he had taken off the shelf and put it back in its place. So he says, but suppose Dustfinger didn't actually want to take him along? Suppose he left him behind on purpose? Would that surprise you? No. No, it wouldn't. Maggie said nothing. It was so quiet among the books, so terribly quiet among all those words. I know, Maggie, Mo said at last in a low voice. I know you think the world that book describes is much more exciting than this one. I understand the feeling. I've often imagined being right inside one of my favorite books. But we both know that once imagination turns to reality, things feel quite different. You think the Ink World is a magical place, a world of wonders. But believe me, your mother has told me a lot about it that you wouldn't like at all. It's a cruel, dangerous place, full of darkness and violence, ruled by brute force, Maggie, not by justice. He looked at her, searching her face for the understanding he had always found there before, but did not find now.
Farid comes from a world like that, said Maggie, and he didn't choose to get into this story of ours. You brought him here.
She regretted her words the moment they were out. Mo turned away as if she had struck him.
Yes, you're right. Of course, he said, going back to the door.
And I don't want to quarrel with you again. But I don't want that paper lying around your room, either. Give it back to Farid, or else who knows, there could be a giant sitting on your bed tomorrow morning. He was trying to make her laugh, of course. He couldn't bear the two of them to be on bad terms again. He looked so depressed, and so tired.
You know perfectly well nothing like that can happen, said Maggie. Why do you always worry so much? Things don't just come out of the words on the page unless you call them. You should know that better than anyone.
His hand was still on the door handle. Yes, he said. Yes, no doubt you're right. But do you know what? Sometimes I'd like to put a padlock on all the books in this world. And as for that very special book, I'd be glad now if Capricorn really had burned the last copy back there in his village. That book brings bad luck, Maggie. Nothing but bad luck. Even if you won't believe me. Then he closed the library door after him. Maggie stood there motionless until his footsteps had died away. She went over to one of the windows looking out to the garden, but when Mo finally came down the path leading to his workshop, he didn't look back at the house. Risa was with him. She had put her arm around his shoulders, and her other hand was tracing words. But Maggie couldn't make them out. Were they talking about her? It was sometimes an odd feeling suddenly to have not just a father, but two parents who talked to each other when she wasn't with them. Mo went into his workshop alone, and Risa strolled back to the house. She waved to Maggie when she saw her standing at the window, and Maggie waved back. An odd feeling. Maggie sat among Eleanor's books for some time longer, looking first at one, then at another, searching for passages to drown out her own thoughts. But the letters on the pages remained just letters, forming neither pictures nor words. And finally, Maggie went out into the garden, lay down on the grass, and looked at the workshop. She could see Mo at work through its windows. I can't do it, she thought as the wind blew leaves off the trees and whirled them away like brightly painted toys. No, I can't. They'll all be so worried, and Mo will never, ever say a word to me again. Maggie thought all those things. She thought them over and over again. And at the same time, she knew, deep down inside her, that she had made up her mind long ago.
Chapter 8 The Minstrel Woman. It was getting light when Dustfinger reached the farm that Cloud Dancer had described to him. It lay on a south side facing slope, surrounded by olive trees. The soil, said Cloud Dancer, was poor and stony there, but it suited the herbs that Roxanne grew. The house stood alone, with no village nearby to protect it. There was only a wall, hardly chest high, and a wooden gate. You could see the rooftops of Ombra in the distance, the castle towers rising high above the houses, and the road winding toward the city gate.
so near and yet too far to be a refuge if highwaymen or soldiers coming home from war thought it a good idea to loot this lonely farm where only a woman and two children lived.
Perhaps she at least has a farmhand, thought Dustfinger as he stood behind some bushes of broom.
Their branches hid him, but he had a good view of the house.
It was small, like most farmhouses. Not as poor as many of them, but not much better either. The whole house would have fit a dozen times over and more into one of the great halls where Roxanne had once danced. Even the Adderhead used to invite her to his castle, poorly as he thought of the motley folk, for in those days everyone had wanted to hear her sing. Rich traders, the miller down by the river, the spice merchant who had sent her presents for more than a year, so many men had wanted to marry her, had given her jewelry and costly dresses, offered her fine apartments in their houses, and every one of those apartments was certainly larger than the little house where she lived now. But Roxanne stayed with the motley folk. She had never been one of those women among the strolling players who would sell their voices and their bodies to a lord and master for a little security, a settled home. However, the day had come when she, too, had tired of traveling and had wanted a home for herself and her children, for no law protected those who lived on the road, and that meant the motley folk as well as robbers and highwaymen. If you stole from a player, you need not fear any punishment. If you did violence to one of their women, you could safely go back to your comfortable home, and even if you killed a traveler, you need not fear the hangman. All his widow could do in revenge was strike the killer's shadow as the sun cast it on the city wall. Only his shadow. And she had to pay for her husband's funeral, too. The motley folk were fair game. People called them the devil's decoys. They liked to be entertained by them, listened to their songs and stories, watched their clever tricks, and barred their doors and gates to them when evening came. The players had to camp outside towns and villages, outside the protection of the walls, always on the move, envied for their freedom, yet despised because they served many masters for money and bread. Not many strolling players ever left the road and the lonely paths. But that was obviously what Roxanne had done. There was a stable beside the house, a barn, and a bakehouse, and between them a yard with a well in the middle of it. There was a garden, fenced off to keep chickens and goats from uprooting the young plants, and a dozen narrow fields on the slope beyond. Some had been harvested, while in others the herbs stood high, bushy, and heavy with their own seed. The fragrance borne across the dust finger on the wind made the morning air both sweet and bitter. Roxanne was kneeling in the farthest field among the plants of flax, comfrey, and wild mallow. She seemed to have been at work for a long time already, although the morning mist still hung in the nearby trees. A boy of perhaps 7 or 8 kneeled beside her. Roxanne was talking to him and laughing. How often Dustfinger had summoned up her face in his memory. Every part of it. Her mouth, her eyes, her high forehead. It had been more difficult with every passing year. And with every year, the picture had dimmed as desperately as he had tried to remember more clearly. Time had blurred her face and covered it with dust. Dustfinger took a step forward and 2 steps back. He thought of turning back 3 times already, of stealing away again as silently as he had come. But he had stayed. A wind blew through the broom bushes, catching him in the back as if to give him fresh heart, and Dustfinger plucked up his courage, pushed the branches aside, and walked toward the house and the fields. The boy saw him first, and the goose rose from the tall grass by the stable and came toward him, cackling and beating her wings. Peasants were not allowed to keep dogs. That was a privilege reserved for princes. But a goose was a reliable guard, too, and just as alarming. But Dustfinger knew how to avoid the gaping beak and stroked the excited bird's white neck until she folded her wings like a freshly ironed dress and waddled peacefully away, back to her place in the grass. Roxanne had risen to her feet. She wiped the earth off her hands onto her dress, and looked at him. Just looked. She had indeed pinned up her hair like a farmer's wife, but it was obviously as long as ever and still as black, apart from a few gray strands. Her dress was brown as the earth where she had been kneeling,
no longer brightly colored like the skirts she used to wear. But her face was still as familiar to Dustfinger as the sight of the sky, more familiar than his own reflection. The boy picked up the rake lying on the ground beside him. He clutched it with a grimly determined air, as if he were used to protecting his mother from strangers. "Clever lad," thought Dustfinger. "Never trust anyone, certainly not a scar-faced man like me suddenly emerging from the bushes." What was he going to say when she asked him where he'd been? Roxanne whispered something to the boy, who reluctantly lowered the rake. Suspicion still lingered in his eyes. 10 years. He'd often been gone a long time, in the forest, in the towns on the coast, among the isolated villages lying in the hills around, like a fox that visited farmyards only when its stomach rumbled. "Your heart's a vagabond," Roxanne always said. Sometimes he'd had to search for her when she had moved on with the others. They lived together in the forest for a while in an abandoned charcoal burner's hut, and then in a tent with other strolling players. They'd even managed to hold out within the solid walls of Ombra all one winter. He was always the one who wanted to move on. And when their first daughter was born and Roxanne wanted to stay put more often, in some reasonably familiar place, with the other women among the strolling players, closer to the shelter of walls, he would go off alone. But he always came back to her and the children, much to the annoyance of all the rich men who flocked around her wanting to make an honest woman of her. What had she thought when he had stayed away for a whole 10 years? Had she, like Cloud Dancer, thought him dead? Or did she believe he had simply left without a word, without saying goodbye? He could not find the answer in Roxanne's face. He saw bewilderment there. Anger. Perhaps love, too. Perhaps. She whispered something to the boy, took his hand, and made him walk beside her. She went slowly, as if she must prevent her feet from going faster. He longed to run to her, leaving one of those years behind him at every step, but he had used up all his courage. He stood there, as if rooted to the spot, looking at her as she came toward him after all those years. All the years for which he had no explanation, except one that she wouldn't believe. Only a few paces still separated them when Roxanne stopped. She put her arm around the boy's shoulder, but he pushed it away, of course. He didn't want his mother's arm reminding him how young he still was. How proudly she thrust out her chin. That was the first thing he'd noticed about Roxanne. Her pride. He couldn't help smiling, but he bowed his head so that she couldn't see the smile. "Obviously, no living creature can withstand you to this day. My goose has always driven everyone else off." When Roxanne spoke, there was nothing special about her voice. None of the strength and beauty it had when she sang. "Well, nothing's changed there," he said, "in all these years." And suddenly, as he looked at her, he finally, truly knew that he had come home. It was so strong a sensation that he felt weak at the knees. How happy he was to see her again. How dreadfully, terribly happy. "Ask me," he thought. "Ask me where I've been," although he didn't know how he would explain. But she said only, "You seem to have been well off, wherever you have been." "It only looks like that," he replied. "I didn't stay there of my own free will." Roxanne examined his face as if she had forgotten what it looked like, stroked the boy's hair. It was as black as hers, but his eyes were the eyes of another. They looked at him coldly. Dustfinger rubbed his hands together and whispered fire words to his fingers until sparks fell from them like rain. Where they landed on the stony ground, flowers sprung up. Red flowers, each petal a tongue of flame. The boy stared at them with mingled delight and fear. In the end, he crouched down beside them, and he put his hand out to the fiery flowers. "Careful," warned Dustfinger, but it was already too late. The boy, taken by surprise, put his burned fingertips in his mouth.
"So the fire still obeys you," said Roxanne, and for the first time he detected something like a smile in her eyes. "You look hungry. Come with me."
and without another word she walked toward the house. The boy was still staring at the fiery flowers.
"I've heard that you grow herbs for the healers."
Dustfinger stood indecisively in the doorway.
"Yes, even nettle buys from me."
Nettle, small as a moss woman, always surly, sparing of her words as a beggar with his tongue cut out. But there wasn't a better healer in this world.
"Does she still live in the old bear's cave on the outskirts of the forest?"
Hesitantly, Dustfinger walked through the doorway. It was so low that he had to duck his head. The smell of freshly baked bread rose to his nostrils. Roxanne placed a loaf on the table, brought cheese, oil, olives.
"Yes, but she isn't often there. She's getting more eccentric all the time. She roams the forest, talking to the trees and to herself, looking for plants still unknown to her. Sometimes you don't see her for weeks, so people come to me more and more often these days. Nettle has taught me things in these last few years."
She didn't look at him as she said that.
"She's shown me how to grow herbs in my fields that usually thrive only in the forest. Butterfly clover, jingle bell leaf, and the red anemones where the fire elves get their honey. I didn't know those anemones could be used for healing, too. They can't. I planted them because they reminded me of someone."
This time she did look at him. Dustfinger put out his hand to one of the bunches of herbs hanging from the ceiling and rubbed the dry flowers between his fingers. Lavender, where vipers hide, and helpful if they bite you.
"I expect they grow only here because you sing for them," he said. "Didn't folk always say, when Roxanne sings, the stones burst into flower?"
Roxanne cut some bread, poured oil into a bowl.
"I only sing for the stones these days," she said. "And for my son."
She handed him the bread.
"Here, eat this. I baked it only yesterday."
Then turning her back to him, she went over to the fire. Dustfinger watched her surreptitiously as he dipped a piece of bread into the oil. Two sacks of straw and a couple of blankets on the bed, a bench, a chair, a table, pitchers, baskets, bottles and bowls, bundles of dried herbs under the ceiling, crammed close together the way they used to hang in Nettle's cave, and a chest that looked strangely fine in this otherwise sparsely furnished room. Dustfinger still remembered the cloth merchant who had given it to Roxanne. It was a heavy load for his servants to carry, and it had been full to the brim with silken dresses embroidered with pearls, the sleeves edged with lace.
Were they still there in the chest?
Unworn, useless for working in the fields?
"I went to Nettle when Rosanna first fell ill."
Roxanne did not turn to him as she spoke.
"I didn't know anything, not even how to draw the fever out of her. Nettle showed me all she knew, but nothing helped our daughter. So I rode to see the barn owl with her, while her fever rose higher and higher. I took her into the forest to the fairies, but they didn't help me either. They might have done it for you, but you weren't there."
Dustfinger saw her pass the back of her hand over her eyes.
"Cloud Dancer told me."
He knew these were not the right words, but he could find no better. Roxanne just nodded and passed her hand over her eyes again.
"Some say that you can see people you love even after death," she said quietly. "They say the dead visit you by night, or at least in your dreams. Your longing for them calls them back, if only for a little while. Rosanna didn't come. I went to women who said they could speak to the dead. I burned herbs whose fragrance was supposed to summon her, and I lay awake long nights hoping that she will come back. At least once. But it was all lies. There's no way back. Or have you been there? Did you find one?"
"In the realm of the dead? No." Dustfinger shook his head with a sad smile. "No, I didn't go quite so far. But believe me, if I had, that even from there, I'd have sought some way to get back to you."
How long she looked at him.
No one else had ever looked at him like that. And once again he tried to find words, words that could explain where he had been, but there were none.
"When Rosanna died..."
Roxanne's tongue seemed to shrink from the word, as if it could kill her daughter a second time.
"When she died, I held her in my arms. I swore something to myself. I swore that never,
Never again would I be so helpless when death tried to take away someone I love. I've learned a great deal since then. Perhaps today I could cure her, or perhaps not.
She looked at him again, and when he returned her glance, he did not try to hide his pain, as he usually would.
Where did you bury her? Behind the house, where she always used to play.
He turned to the open door, wanting at least to see the earth under which she lay, but Roxanne held him back.
Where have you been?
She whispered, laying her forehead against his chest. He stroked her hair, stroked the fine gray strands like silken cobwebs running through the sooty black, and buried his face in it. She still mixed a little bitter orange into the water when she washed her hair. Its perfume brought back so many memories that he felt dizzy.
Far away, he said. I've been very, very far away.
Then he just stood there holding her tightly, unable to believe that she was really there again. Not just a figment of his dreams, not just a memory, blurred and vague, but a woman, of flesh and blood, with fragrant hair.
And she was not sending him away. How long they simply stood there like that,
they didn't know.
What about our older girl, Brianna? How is Brianna?
He asked at last.
She's been living up in the castle for 4 years now. She serves Violante, the prince's daughter-in-law. Known to everyone as her ugliness.
She came out of his arms, smoothed her pinned-up hair, and reached for his hands.
Brianna sings for Violante, looks after her spoiled little son, and reads to her, she said. Violante adores books, but her eyesight is bad, so she can't easily read them for herself. Let alone that she must do it in secret because the prince thinks poorly of women who read. But Brianna can read.
Yes, and I've taught my son to read, too.
What's his name? Jihan.
After his father. Roxanne went over to the table and touched the flowers standing on it.
Did I know him? No. He left me this farm, and a son. The fire raiser set light to our barn, and he ran in to save the livestock, and the fire consumed him. Isn't it strange that you can love two men, and fire protects one of them? But it kills the other.
She was silent for some time before she spoke again. Firefox was leader of the arsonists then. They were almost worse than under Capricorn.
Pasta and Capricorn disappeared at the same time as you. Did you know?
Yes, I've heard, he murmured, unable to take his eyes off her. How lovely she was. How beautiful. Oh, it almost hurt. To look at her. When she came toward him again, every movement reminded him of the day he had first seen her dance.
The fairies did very well, she said quietly, stroking his face. If I didn't know better, I'd think someone had simply painted those scars on your face with a silver pencil.
A lie, but a kind one, he said just as softly. No one knew better than Roxanne where the scars came from. They would neither of them forget the day when the Adderhead had commanded her to dance and sing before him. Capricorn had been there, too, with Basta and all the other fire-raisers, and Basta had stared at Roxanne like a tomcat eyeing a tasty bird. He had pursued her day after day, promising her gold and jewels, threatening and flattering her. And when she rejected him again and again, alone and in company, Basta made inquiries to discover the identity of the man she preferred to him. He lay in wait for Duskfinger on his way to Roxanne with two other men, who held him down, while Basta cut his face.
You didn't marry again after your husband died.
You fool, he thought.
Are you jealous of a dead man?
No. The only man on this farm is Jihan.
The boy appeared in the doorway as suddenly as if he had been listening behind it, just waiting for his name to be spoken. Without a word, he made his way past Dustfinger and sat down on the bench.
The flowers are even bigger now, he said.
Did you burn your fingers on them?
Only a little.
Roxanne pushed a jug of cold water over to him.
Here, dip them in that, and if it doesn't help, I'll break an egg for you, It's nothing better for burns than a little egg white.
Jihan obediently put his fingers in the jug, still looking at Dustfinger.
Doesn't he ever burn himself?
He asked his mother. Roxanne had to smile. No, never. Fire loves him. It licks his fingers. Kisses him.
Jihan looked at Dustfinger as if his mother had said that fairy and not human blood ran in his veins.
Careful, she's teasing you, said Dustfinger. Of course it bites me too. Those scars on your face, they weren't made by fire?
No. Dustfinger helped himself to more bread. This woman, Violante, he said. Cloud Dancer told me that the Outer Head is her father. Does she hate the Stolen Players as much as he does?
No.
Roxanne ran her fingers through Jihan's black hair. If Violante hates anyone, it's her father himself.
She was 7 when he sent her here. She was married to Cosimo when she was 12, and 6 years later she was a widow. Now there she sits in her father-in-law's castle, trying to care for his subjects, as he has long neglected to do in his mourning for his son. Violante feels for the weak. Beggars, cripples, widows with hungry children, peasants who can't pay their taxes, they all go to her. But Violante is a woman. Any power she has is only because everyone is afraid of her father, even on this side of the forest. Brianna likes it at the castle.
Jihan wiped his wet fingers on his trousers and looked at their reddened tips with concern. Roxanne dipped his fingers back into the cold water.
Yes, I'm afraid so, she said. Our daughter likes to wear Violante's cast-off clothes, sleep in a soft four-poster bed, and have the fine folk at court pay her compliments. But I don't care for it, and she knows I don't.
The ugly lady sends for me too sometimes.
There was no mistaking the pride in Jehan's voice.
To play with her son. Jacopo pesters her and Brianna when they are reading, and no one else will play with him because he always starts screaming when you have a fight with him. And when he loses, he shouts that he's going to have your head chopped off! Ah!
You let him play with the prince's brat?
Dustfinger cast Roxanne an anxious glance.
Whatever their age, princes are never friends to anyone. Have you forgotten that? And the same is true for their daughters, especially if the Arred is their father.
Roxanne made her way past him in silence.
You don't have to remind me what princes are like, she said. Your daughter is 15 years old now. It's a long time since she took any advice from me. But who knows? Maybe she'll listen to her father, even if she hasn't seen him for 10 years. Next Sunday, the Laughing Prince is holding festivities to celebrate his grandson's birthday. A good fire eater is sure to be welcome at the castle, since Soothbird is the only one they've had to entertain them all these years.
She stopped in the open doorway.
Come along, Jihan, she said. Your fingers don't look too bad, and there's plenty of work still to do.
The boy obeyed without protest. At the door, he cast a last, curious look at Dustfinger, then ran off. And Dustfinger was left alone in the little house. He looked at the pots and pans near the fire, the wooden bowls, the spinning wheel in the corner, and the chest that spoke of Roxanne's past. Yes, it was a simple house, not much bigger than a charcoal burner's hut. But it was a home, something that Roxanne had always wanted. She had never liked to have only the sky above her by night, even if he made the fire grow flowers for her. Flowers to watch over her sleep.
Chapter 9. Meggie Reads. When all was quiet in Eleanor's house, and the garden was bright in the moonlight, Meggie put on the dress that Risa had made for her. Several months ago, she had asked her mother what kind of clothes women wore in the Ink World.
Which women? Risa had inquired. Farmers' wives, strolling players, princes' daughters, maidservants.
What did you wear?
Maggie asked. And Risa had gone into the nearest town with Darius and bought some dress material there. Plain, coarsely woven red fabric. Then she had asked Eleanor to bring the old sewing machine up from the cellar.
That's the sort of dress I wore when I was living in Capricorn's fortress as a maid, her hands had said, putting the finished dress over Maggie's head.
It would have been too fine for a peasant woman,
but it was just about good enough for a rich man's servant, and Mortola was very keen that we shouldn't be much worse dressed than the prince's maids, even if we only served a gang of fire raisers.
Maggie stood in front of her wardrobe mirror and examined herself in the dull glass. She looked strange to herself, and she'd be a stranger in the ink world, too. A dress alone couldn't alter that. A stranger, just as Dustfinger was here, she thought, and she remembered the unhappiness in his eyes.
Nonsense, she told herself, crossly pushing back her smooth hair. I'm not planning to spend 10 years there.
The sleeves of the dress were already a little too short, and it was stretched tight over her breasts, too.
Good heavens, Maggie,
Eleanor had exclaimed when she realized, for the first time, that they weren't as flat as the cover of a book anymore.
Well, I imagine your Pippi Longstocking days are over now.
They hadn't found anything suitable for Fareed to wear. Not in the attic, or in the trunks of clothes down in the cellar that smelled of mothballs and cigar smoke, but he didn't seem to mind.
Who cares? If it works, we'll start out in the forest, he said. No one will be interested in my jeans there, and as soon as we come to a village or town, I'll steal myself something to wear.
Everything always seemed so simple to him. He couldn't understand that Maggie felt guilty because of Moe and Risa any more than he understood her anxiety to find the right clothes. When she confessed that she could hardly look Moe and her mother in the eye after deciding to go with them, he had just asked,
Why?
Looking at her blankly.
You're 13. Surely they'd be marrying you off to someone quite soon anyway.
Marrying me off?
Maggie had felt the blood rise to her face. But how could she talk about such things to a boy out of a story in The Thousand and One Nights, where all women were servants or slave girls, or lived in a harem? Anyway, added Fareed, kindly ignoring the fact that she was still blushing, you're not intending to stay very long, are you?
No, she wasn't.
She wanted to taste and smell and feel the ink world, see the fairies and princes, and then come home again to Moe and Risa, Eleanor and Darius. There was just one problem. The words Orpheus had written might take her into Dustfinger's story, but they couldn't bring her back. Only one person could ride her back again. Fenolio, the inventor of the world she wanted to visit. The creator of glassmen and blue-skinned fairies, of Dustfinger and Basta too. Yes, only Fenolio could help her to return. Every time Maggie thought of that, her courage drained away and she felt like canceling the whole plan, striking out those three little words she had added to what Orpheus had written. And the girl.
Suppose she couldn't find Fenolio. Suppose he wasn't even in his own story anymore.
Oh, come on, he must still be there, she told herself whenever that thought made her heart beat faster. He can't simply write himself back, not without someone to read what he's written aloud.
But suppose Fenolio had found another reader there, someone like Orpheus or Darius. The gift didn't seem to be unique, as she and Moe had once thought.
No, he's still there, I'm sure he is, thought Maggie for the 100th time, reading her goodbye letter to Moe and Risa once more. She herself didn't know why she had chosen to write it on the letterhead that she and Moe had designed together. That was hardly going to mollify him.
Dearest Moe, dear Risa,
Maggie knew the words by heart.
Please don't worry. Fareed has to find Dustfinger to warn him about Basta, and I'm going too. I won't stay long. I just want to see the Wayless Wood, the Laughing Prince, and Cosimo the Fair, and perhaps the Black Prince and Cloud Dancer. I want to see the fairies again, and the Glassmen, and Fenolio. He'll write me back here. You know he can do it, so don't worry. Capricorn isn't in the ink world anymore after all. See you soon. Lots of love and kisses. Maggie. P.S. I'll bring you back a book, Mo. Apparently there are wonderful books there, handwritten books full of pictures like the ones in Eleanor's glass cases. Only even better. Please don't be angry.
She'd torn up this letter and rewritten it 3 times, but that made matters no better, because she knew that there were no words that could stop Mo from being angry with her, and Risa from weeping with anxiety, the way she did the day Maggie came home from school 2 hours later than usual. She put the letter on her pillow, they couldn't miss seeing it there, and went over to the mirror again.
Maggie, she thought, What are you doing? What do you think you're doing?
But her reflection did not reply. When she let Farid into her room just after midnight, he was surprised to see her dress. I don't have shoes to go with it, she said, but luckily it's quite long and I don't think my boots show much, do they? Farid just nodded. It looks lovely, he murmured awkwardly. Maggie locked the door after letting him in and took the key out of the lock so that it could be unlocked again from the outside. Eleanor had a second key, and though she probably wouldn't be able to find it at first, Darius would know where it was. Maggie glanced at the letter on her pillow once more. Over his shoulder, Farid had the backpack she had found in Eleanor's attic.
"Oh, he's welcome to it," Eleanor had said when Maggie asked her. "It once belonged to an uncle of mine. I hated him. The boy can put that smelly Martin in it. I like the idea."
The Martin? Maggie's heart missed a beat. Farid didn't know why Dustfinger had left Gwyn behind, and Maggie hadn't told him, although she knew the reason only too well. She herself, after all, had told Dustfinger what part the Martin was to play in his story. He was to die a dreadful, violent death because of Gwyn, if what Finolio had written came true. But Farid just shook his head sadly when she asked him about the Martin.
"He's gone," said the boy. "I tied him up in the garden because the bookworm woman kept on me about her birds, but he gnawed through the rope. I looked for him everywhere, but I just can't find him."
Clever Gwyn.
"He'll have to stay here," said Maggie. "Orpheus didn't write anything about him, and Risa will look after him. She likes him."
Farid nodded and glanced unhappily at the window, but he didn't contradict her. The Wayless Wood. That was where Orpheus's words would take them. Farid knew where Dustfinger had meant to go after arriving in the forest. To Umbra, where the Laughing Prince's castle stood, and that was where Maggie hoped to find Finolio, too. He had often told her about Umbra when they were both Capricorn's prisoners. One night, when neither of them could sleep because Capricorn's men were shooting at stray cats outside again, Finolio had whispered to Maggie,
"If I could choose to see one place in the Ink World, then it would be Umbra. After all, the Laughing Prince is a great lover of books, which can hardly be said of his adversary, the Adderhead. Yes, life must surely be good for a writer in Umbra. A room in an attic somewhere, perhaps an alley where the cobblers and the saddlers work, their trades don't smell too bad, and a glass man to sharpen my quills, huh? And a few fairies over my bed, and I could look down into the alley through my window and see all life pass by."
"What are you taking with you?" Farid's voice startled Maggie out of her thoughts. "You know we're not supposed to bring too much."
"Of course I know." Did he think that just because she was a girl she needed a dozen dresses? All she was going to carry was the old leather bag that had always gone with her and Mo on their travels when she was little. It would remind her of Mo, and she hoped that in the Ink World it would be as inconspicuous as her dress. But the thing she'd stuffed into it would certainly attract attention if anyone saw them. A hairbrush made of plastic, modern like the buttons on the cardigan she had packed, also a couple of pencils, a penknife, a photograph of her parents, and one of Eleanor. She had thought hard about what book to take. Going without one would have seemed to her like setting off naked, but it mustn't be a heavy book. So, it had to be a paperback.
"Books and beach clothes," Mo called them. "Badly dressed for most occasions, but useful when you're on vacation."
Eleanor didn't have a single paperback on her shelves, but Maggie herself owned a few. In the end, she had decided on one that Risa had given her, a collection of stories set near the lake that lay close to Eleanor's house. That way she would be taking a little bit of home with her, for Eleanor's house was her home now, more than anywhere else she had ever been. And who knew? Maybe Finolio would be able to use the words in it to write her back into her own story. Farid had gone to the window. It was open, and a cool wind was blowing into the room, moving the curtains that Risa had made. Maggie shivered in her new dress. The nights were still very mild. But what would the season be in the Ink World? Perhaps it was winter there.
I ought to say goodbye to him at least, murmured Farid.
Gwyn,
he called softly into the night air, clicking his tongue. Maggie quickly pulled away from the window.
Don't do that, she snapped. Do you want to wake up everyone? I've already told you Gwyn will be fine here. He's probably found a female Martin by now. There are a few around the place. Eleanor's always afraid they'll eat